right. So this morning we're going to do two sessions, and then we'll do some Q&A. The first session, I'm just going to give you a heads up, is rough. I mean, hopefully the talk isn't rough, but the content is rough. What we're going to talk about is challenging. But I want to remind you that we are ending with hope. We are ending with the gospel. And so as we go through this difficult first session, bear with me. If you feel a little glum afterwards, I don't blame you. How is it possible to live in one of the most advanced, prosperous, and free nations in history and sense that our lives are at some fundamental level not right? How is it possible to carry around historically unimaginable tools of communication in our pockets, to live on a planet with 7.6 billion people with a B, and yet suffer from a crisis of loneliness? I don't know if I'm going to mention this, but something like 5%, I think I do mention this, something like 5% of men have close friends or something like that. I'll get to it later. There's a crisis of loneliness. That's what I need you to understand. How is it possible to know more about the human mind neurologically and psychologically than any other point of human history, a body of knowledge developed over centuries through hundreds of thousands of intricate peer-reviewed scientific journals and studies, and yet we have a growing mental health crisis? How is it possible that we can have perpetual, high-quality, affordable access to virtually limitless streams of entertainment of every genre, style, and medium imaginable, and yet we feel terribly bored? How is it possible that with each year we gain new systems, technologies, and services that allow us to be more efficient than ever before, and yet our work seems to invade more and more parts of our lives? We are not right. Now, I could give you plenty of other examples of the deep disorder in our society. Things like declining life expectancy, drug overdoses, mental health crises, the Great Resignation, and so on. But I'd like to put this evidence on pause for a moment and try to get at the problem in a more direct way. Do you ever catch yourself saying something like, "I just need to get through the day"? Do you catch yourself saying it every day? Or maybe something like, "I just need to," in general, as in, "I just need to start working out," or "I just need to sleep more," or "I just need to study harder," or "I just need to be more disciplined." And these phrases are always accompanied with a feeling of inadequacy or helplessness, as if you know everything you need to do to live a good, fulfilling, satisfying life, but you are even more aware that you aren't able to do everything that is necessary. In a moment, we'll discuss how we modern people tend to cope with this feeling of helplessness and inadequacy, but for now, I want to name it. Life feels unsustainable. We might go so far as to say that modern life does not seem to be designed for humans. The first thing that I'm going to argue this morning is that the contemporary world, at least in the West, was not designed for human beings, not as God made us. Think about this. All societies are formed based on some conception of what it means to be a human being. So if you begin with a false conception, a false anthropology, you're going to build an alien environment, which sounds awesome. I like science fiction, but the alien environment is actually not awesome. It's a place where people suffer. To understand this, I want to talk about the Baylor Bears. I went to Baylor for my PhD, and they only have one now, but they had two live bears on campus. I don't know if they're black bears or brown bears. I don't know from bears. I don't teach bears. I teach literature. But there were these bears on campus, and I would take my two young kids to go see them regularly, because it was like a free little mini zoo right in the middle of campus. These bears, the history of having live bears on campus started around 1945 from my research. According to what I've read, some college students had a bear in their backyard, and I don't know how, and the campus confiscated it. because they didn't want college students having bears. Pretty good policy. Not a good idea to let college students have bears. And so how they got the bear, I don't know. But the Baylor captured the bear and brought it to campus as a live mascot. In 1945, they built a complex for this bear. It was called the Bear Pit. And our basketball cheering section, the student section, is still called the Bear Pit in its honor. And it was literally a pit. It was a bunch of concrete and a pond, and that was it. Well, in 1976, they redesigned this bear pit, and it looked sort of like an above-ground swimming pool slash prison. It was also made out of primarily concrete, but now we've got AstroTurf, so fake grass and a pond and a bunch of concrete. I don't know if you know this, but bears don't typically live in such environments. So in 2004, they begin to redesign. They spend millions of dollars redesigning the living space, the habitat for these bears. And I want to read you some of the language that they use to describe this. They say, the new habitat will enhance the bears' living environment and provide a home more like their natural habitat. So the key point here is you have experts getting together, bear experts getting together. There's probably a name for that. Bear experts getting together to design a habitat that is most close to the natural one. Intentionality. The director of the Baylor Chamber of Commerce said that the current habitat was constructed in 2005 with the intention of, quote, a bear's dream world. Which I think raises a lot of questions. For example, how does one know what a bear's dream world is? How could you possibly know that? So here's a description of what they ended up building. The 2,000 square foot facility features three caves, a waterfall, three wading ponds, a night house, and more. It is rated for a Category 5 hurricane and is the safest place on campus. Unless you're a human and the bears are hungry, in which case it seems like it would not be a very safe place. It's accredited with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It is licensed by the USDA as a Class C zoo. Today, the bears enjoy a wide range of fresh, raw meats, fruits, and vegetables. Now, as I said, I was a graduate student at Baylor at this time, and I could not afford fresh meats, fruits, and vegetables. I did not live in a 2,000-square-foot facility. Our apartment did have a waterfall because the bathtub on the second floor would leak into the first floor. So here's this space. Millions of dollars are spent. Intentionality is used to create a habitat that is most like what bears live in. And yet when I would take my two kids to go see these bears, guess what the bears were doing? They were pacing in circles all day long. And you could see they got real grass at this point, but the real grass was worn down into a path that they would walk all day long, compulsively. It was very clear to me and to anyone who saw these bears that they were unwell. They weren't right. They were sick in some way. You see, this space was designed for bears, but not for bears as they actually are. Actual bears are not the kinds of things that can be put in captivity. They don't flourish in a cage. Now, eventually, through breeding and training, you might be able to adapt the animal to a false environment, but we know at that point it's no longer a bear. Instead, we call it a bear raised in captivity, and we know it's a different kind of animal. Now, I'm not going to say that we are caged in a zoo, Class C or otherwise, and yet I don't think it's wrong to say that we live in a habitat that was similarly not designed for us, not designed for humans as God made us. We certainly share a kind of zoocosis. That's the name for that pacing. If you've been to a zoo and seen a lion or a tiger or a bear or any other animal pacing compulsively, it's called zoochosis, a psychosis of captive animals. An anxious, tiring, bored, endless pacing, a weariness. We feel that we are trapped and out of place. Now, wait a minute, Alan. You might think to yourself, I actually know quite a few people who live happy, content, interesting lives. This society you just described sounds nothing like their daily experience, and yet I do wonder. Take away their phones, their computers, their TVs, podcasts, exercise classes, 80-hour work weeks, shopping sprees, planners, for an hour, and would they not begin to feel the weight of their own existence constricting them? Would they not begin to feel worry and anxiety, a fear of missing out, of falling behind, of wasting away? Would not their conscience begin calling up memories of failures, doubts, and insecurities? Thankfully, the modern world is perfectly designed for people that are afraid of being alone with themselves. You see, smartphones weren't designed to be addictive against our wills. We want to be addicted to screens because a screen into another world is a much, much safer experience than a mirror into our own lives. A screen can divert our attention from the disorder right in front of us, even in our own hearts. So how many of those who seem to be living interesting lives are only able to get out of bed in the morning because of the momentum of life, because they have a job or school or something to do? How many of those who seem to live fulfilling lives are merely filling their lives? I don't doubt for a minute that many people live stimulating, pleasurable, and interesting lives, comfortable lives, but so do many cats and dogs. And if humans are distinct from animals, and we are, then stimulation and pleasure and physical comfort are inadequate measures of what it means to live a good life for God. Please don't misunderstand me. I don't mean that everybody is absolutely miserable beneath the surface, but I do think a lot of us are anxious, lonely, tired, bored, overwhelmed, and tired again. The model for many contemporary people is, I just need to get through the day. I just need to survive. And to cope with this, to survive, a lot of us self-medicate. Some drink, some take prescription antidepressants or stimulants or anti-anxiety meds, some eat, some binge-watch friends, some work more, some work out more, some cut themselves, some immerse themselves in the news, some immerse themselves in porn, some play video games, some shop, some sleep, some scroll endlessly through TikTok, some post endlessly on Twitter, some argue online, some obsess about their health, some obsess about the environment or the climate. Some protest online, some protest to be famous online, some travel, some attempt suicide, some attempt self-improvement, some abuse people, some join extremist movements, some join multi-level marketing programs about the same thing, some take up yoga, some take up gambling, some take up extreme sports, some discover a new identity, some modify their bodies, some modify their diets, but we all seem to medicate because if we don't, we're not sure we can get through the day. Now, if that sounds pessimistic, let's consider a couple of trends in our country, specifically mental illness. Among young Americans, there has been a dramatic increase in mental illness diagnoses. College campuses have been ground zero for this issue, but most schools have failed to keep up. In my own experience as a professor, students suffering from mental illnesses are not actually snowflakes. On the contrary, many times I've had to urge students to get the help that they need because they prefer to keep their problems to themselves and try to muscle through, even as their lives are falling apart. Young people are torn up over broken families, child abuse, anxiety, depression, loneliness, imposter syndrome, choice paralysis, porn addiction, and many other things. One survey found that nearly 43% of undergraduates felt so depressed that it was difficult to function. 43%, difficult to function. (clears throat) 64% said they felt overwhelming anxiety. Between the scholarly research on the mental health crisis in college campuses and my own personal experience with students, I've come to assume that in any given class, There will be several students suffering from a diagnosed mental illness. Others will be survivors of sexual abuse, and many others will struggle with depression, anxiety, and aimlessness that is not diagnosed. Now, the rise in mental illness diagnoses can be partially explained by heightened awareness of mental illness and decreased taboos, but that's not the whole story. Something else has changed. Our children are not right. Neither are the rest of us. According to the CDC, during the 2011 and 2014 years, almost 13% of persons aged 12 and over took an antidepressant in the last month. The widespread use of psychiatric medication led one historian of psychiatry to remark, "We've come to a place, at least in the West, where it seems every other person is depressed and on medication." You do have to wonder what that says about our culture. More alarming is the trend of declining life expectancy in America. In November of 2018, so before COVID, the CDC director released a statement that said that tragically, this troubling trend is largely driven by deaths from drug overdoses and suicides. In other words, a significant segment of the American population finds life unbearable. Some cope with medication, but others turn to opiates and suicide. In their carefully researched study of the declining life expectancy, economists Ann Case and Angus Denton repeatedly point to the loss of meaningful experiences by less educated Americans who have experienced the loss of fulfilling work, marriages, churches, and communities. I don't know if you know this, but again, before COVID, America started to see a decline in our life expectancy. In industrialized countries, life expectancy has historically only gone one direction, up. But it started dipping down, particularly for middle-aged men without college degrees in America. The last time this happened was the Spanish flu and the First World War. It takes a lot to dip a life expectancy. And the three big things that we're doing it are alcohol-related deaths, suicides, and drug overdoses. And these two economists point out that all three of those are forms of suicide, slow forms of suicide. Deaths of despair, they called them. The way we live together is sick. Here's that figure I was talking about earlier that I couldn't remember. Between 1990 and 2021, the percentage of men who said they had no close friends, went from 3% in 1990, so 93 or 97% had close friends, to 15% in 2021. Now, I'm not great at math, but that's a five-fold increase. 15% of men in 2021 said they have no close friends. You may not have experienced this yet in life, but life is terribly difficult to get through without close friends. Living in a society governed by technique conditions us to believe that life is easier than it has ever been. Technique is the use of rational methods to maximize efficiency, and we see it everywhere. Think about this. Time-saving technology, apps that maximize our workouts, medicines that drown out irrational thoughts, entertainment in our pockets, scientifically proven methods for parenting, working, eating, shopping, budgeting, folding clothes, sleeping, sex, dating, and buying a car. The promise of technique is that we are collectively overcoming all of life's challenges through research, technology, and discipline. All you have to do is find the right self-help book, the right life hack or app or life coach or devotional. Just to give you an example of this, of the ubiquity of this idea of technique, Harvard Business Review did a study recently asking employees what they wanted as far as benefits in their workplace. How can we improve our workspace? And a third of employees felt that they did not get enough natural lighting. That was one of the highest ranked things that employees wanted in their workspace. They wanted natural lighting. Now, that to me was pretty sad because it's sad that you have to tell people, your employees would like to see the sun, if that's possible. Speaking of inhuman environments, right? But what was most interesting was what followed up this discovery, this finding. This is what they said. Let me see if I can find the right quote. How do you think, because this was written Harvard Business Review, so this is written for employers. How do you think they justified, how do you think they argued for more natural lighting? What reason did they give? You know the answer. More productive. That's right. We know this. That's exactly what they said. So they said, give your employees natural lighting, not because humans were made to be exposed to the sun, right? Not because this is what they are asking for and this will make them happier, but because it will make them more productive. That's an example of technique. Technique is so deeply embedded into our psyches that we want to justify everything in terms of productivity or efficiency, even when it's just a basic life thing. But technique's promise that life is easier than ever turns out to be just another source of dread and shame. Think about this. If life doesn't have to be this hard, if there are answers and methods and practices that can solve all my problems, then it's really my fault that I am overwhelmed or a failure. There's always another system, another technique that can beat the political system, that can improve myself, that can compensate for my biology. So if I'm not living to my full potential, then I am to blame for not taking advantage of these methods. So why all this suffering that I've just described? What if at the core of this is a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be a human being? That's my thesis. I think that we have created a society based on an assumption that we are our own and belong to ourselves. But if this anthropology is fundamentally wrong, if this idea of what it means to be human is fundamentally wrong, then we should expect people to suffer. And that's precisely what we discover when we look around. The difference between us and the bear pacing is that we are more successful at treating our psychosis, at adapting to our environment. We don't mind so much pacing back and forth, especially if we can listen to a podcast while we do so. You see, every society is based on a specific idea of what it means to be a human being. We design our laws, our buildings, our cities, our practices, our moral norms, our cultural works, our movies, our stories, our clothes, markets, entertainment, art forms, politics, technology, schools, even our churches, based on how we conceive of what a human person is. What does it mean to be human? Remember back to those bears. Like the Baylor Bears, our habitat was intentionally designed for us. Like the bears, it was designed by experts. Like the bears, it was designed for our flourishing. This is our dream world. Like those bears, it was progressively improved, and with a specific idea of what a human is. But it was a flawed conception. That's the key. They assumed that a bear was a kind of animal that could be kept in captivity. What was interesting in doing research for this is studying how they treat zoocosis in captive animals. Two things that they do. One, antidepressants, and two, enrichment activities. When I read that, I was like, wait a minute, that's me. That's how you say my problems are going to be solved. You give me antidepressants and you tell me I just need to exercise more or watch better shows and then my problems will go away. It's the same fundamental thing. As we will see, our society goes a step further than the promise given to the bears. It makes a promise that Baylor can't make. It tells us you can be happy and flourish in your habitat if you do certain things, if you accept that you are your own and belong to yourself. And society says, we will give you the tools to do that. The problem is, this tool society gives us to live fulfilling lives only make us more addicted, stressed, and overwhelmed. Think about social media. Now, assuming most of you are Christian in this room, you might be thinking, Mr. Noble, I'm sorry, I don't believe that I belong to myself. My identity is in Christ. You are preaching to the wrong audience. And my first response would be, please, my father was Mr. Noble. Call me Dr. Noble. This is where I get to sip my coffee. A well-timed joke. Second, ideas are insidious. Insidious means sneaky and deadly and dangerous. Bad ideas can worm their ways into our hearts like the snake in the garden. My point is merely this. If you hear this idea that we are our own and belong to ourselves, and you imagine that it's a secular idea that people out there, outside the church, who are ignorant, have, rather than a deeply deep and persuasive societal force that affects virtually all of us, then I think you're mistaken. Now, where does this idea come from? It comes from nearly every corner of our lives, from teachers, parents, pastors, unfortunately, movies, songs. We've been given a promise. Here's the promise. You are the author of your story. You are the only one who can define your identity, your purpose, and your values. This is your life. Other people can give you advice. They can model for you how to live well, how to have the good life. They can post images on Instagram of what it looks like to be happily married or have a great job or exciting and enviable adventures with your friends or to have really holy quiet time with God each morning. But they can't tell you how to live your life. To be a human being is to have the radical and exciting duty to discover meaning for yourself. Now, if you're at all skeptical of this message, I want to share with you one way I've seen this expressed in the world. I was recently driving to Dallas from Oklahoma City when I came across a sign that said, and I quote, "Be the main character. Mint Dental." Now, if you're confused, don't worry. I was too. The idea is simple enough, though. The idea is to have main character energy, which I had to Google to find out what that meant, because I'm old. So here's a quote from Y Pulse magazine explaining what this means. They say, over half of young consumers think of themselves as the main character of their lives. Over the last 2 years, the concept of being the main character of one's life has become very popular on social media. But many young people are taking this idea to heart. In fact, 55% of 13 to 39-year-olds. What kind of a demographic is 13 to 39-year-olds? I don't know. All I know is I'm just outside of that demographic, so this doesn't apply to me. 13 to 39-year-olds tell us that they think of themselves as the main character of their life when given the definition, being the main character of your life is thinking about yourself as the protagonist, actively taking control of your life and trying to focus more on yourself and making your wants and desires first and foremost. Main character energy is an example of how this message that we belong to ourselves is pervasive in society. Here's another example. In her recent NYU commencement, I guess it was about not too recent, it was about a year ago, her NYU commencement speech, Taylor Swift said, "I know it can be really overwhelming figuring out who to be and when, who you are now, and how to act in order to get where you want to go. I have some good news for you. It's totally up to you. It's totally up to you. I also have some terrifying news. It's totally up to you." As we will see, it really is terrifying, belonging to yourself. And part of that terror is that it's not optional. So the promise is, if you accept the responsibilities of belonging to yourself and you strive to be the best version of yourself, then you will be well-adjusted, fulfilled, rewarded, happy, and successful. That's Taylor Swift's good news. So what do I mean by these responsibilities of belonging to yourself? Well, if we are our own and we belong to ourselves, then there are at least five major aspects of our lives that we bear on our shoulders each day. Justification, personal justification, identity, meaning, value, and belonging. And each of these has profound implications on our lives. For example, You have to decide what justifies your life, what makes your life worth living, what gives you purpose and direction. As you can imagine, these responsibilities will lead us to feel exhausted, depressed, overwhelmed, and burned out. And we do. That's the terrifying part that Taylor Swift mentioned. This has many implications, but the overall issue is that our lives are now projects or journeys or quests which we and we alone are responsible for fulfilling and making worthwhile. And to respond to this competition, this burden, most of us fall into two categories, one of two categories. One, affirmation, and two, resignation. Affirmation is the general embrace of contemporary anthropology, the promise of society and its structures. It's someone who says, you know what, I am my own. I do belong to myself. I can fulfill my responsibilities of self-belonging. Society does give me everything I need to live a full and satisfying life. Resignation is someone who says, this anthropology is true, but it sucks. I am my own, and I cannot bear to belong to myself. Society has not given me what I need to compete. I don't have the physical, economic, social, emotional, or mental capital to live a full and satisfying life, so I'm not going to try. Instead, I'm going to find ways of seeking pleasure, of nurturing my bitterness, of tearing down society, of escaping, numbing the pain, or destroying myself, because things cannot turn out well for me. In the end, we'll discuss the truer, better, and more beautiful anthropology, which is that we belong to God, not to ourselves. The idea that to be human is to belong to one who knows us and grounds our being in the world in an embrace of love. And we'll discuss how that changes our responsibilities. But before we can ascend, we have to continue to descend. So I want to look specifically at some of these responsibilities of self-belonging that we all carry. Again, they are justification, identity, meaning, value, and belonging. We'll look at a couple of these in detail. Let's look at justification. For those of us who are Christian, the term justification is loaded with theological meaning, which is only appropriate. But here I'm referring to what I want to call existential or life justification. Instead of the need to be morally and spiritually justified before God, what I'm talking about is the need to have your life justified, giving your life purpose. People who feel that their existence is justified will still feel the need for spiritual and moral justification. Put in a positive way, we ask this question: what is the purpose of my life? Or how can I change the world? Or we tell ourselves that our lives are worthwhile. Put in the negative, we ask ourselves why our lives are worth living. What makes us special? Why is it worth enduring all this suffering? Why is it appropriate for us to take up the earth's limited resources and so on? But it all amounts to the same thing. We have to have an answer for why our life is worth living. There are a couple of different ways of thinking about this. Ernest Becker talks about the miracle of our own face. I love this quote. He says, "One's own face may be godlike in its miraculousness, but one lacks the godlike power to know what it means, the godlike strength to have been responsible for its emergence." By which he means that that the human face entails, the eyes as windows to the soul, the smile which communicates so much human emotion, the features which are so unique and personal, existence itself, your life, your personal being in the world is miraculous. But what are you going to do about it? It's scary when you think about it. Part of what makes this so difficult is that we have an expanding horizon of fullness, which takes typically the form of stories. Stories model for us how we can live a life of fullness. And we have stories modeling every different lifestyle imaginable. If you think about the lifestyle options available to you, it's like a horizon that stretches out endlessly. And the further you go searching for just the right option, just the right life, just the right career that you want, the horizon keeps stretching out. And you think, maybe if I just keep going a little bit further, I'll find the one thing that gives me satisfaction, the one thing that gives me fulfillment. So that's justification. Let's talk about identity. I think that most Christians would readily tell you that they find their identity in Christ, and yet they still spend an inordinate amount of time, energy, and anxiety trying to discover who they are and express it to the world. They, like most everyone else, feel that their identity is tenuous, uncertain, indefinite, vague, and it lacks substance. That it needs constant vigilant expression, reinvention, Instagram posts, and new clothing to be real and meaningful. In other words, we feel like our identities are liquid. Everyone's identity is liquid, shifting under them. And the only way to feel like you know who you are is to express yourself loudly and constantly and in more detail. And if you go too long between social media posts, you may feel like you are disappearing. Remember that scene in Back to the Future? Y'all have seen, this is an old enough crowd to have seen Back to the Future. Back to the Future, classic film, I guess now. As Marty McFly changes his family's history, the photo of his siblings begins to be altered. And his siblings start disappearing slowly from there. I think that's what it's like for us when we go between social media posts. It feels like our existence in the world is slowly disappearing. Maybe you feel like this, maybe you don't, but I do think that Back to the Future image is instructive. Our identity grounds us and orients us in the world, but it is also contested, insecure, tenuous, evolving, and always open for renovations. Our identities are liquid, and we're frantically trying to force this liquid into a solid as it slips through our fingers. Another image I like to use is that of an endless warehouse. Let's imagine a massive, an endless warehouse. The sole purpose of this warehouse is to announce yourself, to say who you are, to say your name. Everyone in this warehouse is yelling their name. And here's the thing. Once you know for sure that you have been heard enough, you can leave. You can leave the warehouse. You are free to go. But the question is, if everyone is shouting their name, who's listening? And why does their opinion matter? And how do you know when they've heard you? And how many people and how clear do they need to hear you for your identity to be secure? These are real world questions for contemporary people. Now, society will help you meet this particular responsibility of self-belonging. Society has created an expanding number of techniques, technologies, and methods of publicly defining and expressing your identity. Think about social media, for example. How each platform adapts, how it introduces new ways to post content and share yourself with the world. And it's not a coincidence that it's highly profitable for corporations if people feel uncertain about their identity. It drives us to spend ridiculous amounts of time online and money on clothing. The point is, society recognizes that we need to each be our own person, and it gives us the tools that claim to help us accomplish this, but guess what? They don't. They always leave us feeling inadequate. They always make us addicted. And in fact, they introduce a greater sense of competition. Remember that warehouse. Everyone is shouting their name. Everyone wants to be heard and known and seen and affirmed. But nobody's listening. One reason that we can't actually build an identity if we belong to ourselves is that identity inherently, by definition, requires a witness. Someone out there who can see us. This is how identity works. If there was only one being in existence, we wouldn't have the concept of identity. And that puts us in a ridiculous position where on the one hand, we'll loudly proclaim that no one can judge us or define us or put us in a box, but we absolutely need the affirmation of other people to feel like we are alive. Even if that affirmation takes the rather pathetic form of likes, shares, and follows. As I said, these techniques or methods for creating your identity, they always end up reminding us of our inadequacy because everyone else uses these same tools. Everyone is trying to do the same thing. Everyone is trying to feel known and alive and affirmed, to have their identity be certain and approved. And so we're all competing for the same attention, the same likes, the same shares, the same affirmation, the same eyes, love, and desire. And guess what? No matter how good you are, someone is better. Someone is more attractive. It turns out the internet reminds us daily, a lot of people are better than us. They're more worthy of people's attention or desire or affirmation. So what possible chance do you stand? Now, I think there are two basic ways of responding to this hyper-competitive society based on a disordered anthropology. I hope I'm not about to get too personal here, but here goes. Some of you here today who have been described as high achievers, although you are not comfortable with that label because you probably realize how inadequate you actually are. But it's true that you set high goals for yourself. You have high standards. When you fail at something, it hurts a lot. You may feel anxious or inadequate or afraid or bitter. But if you're here this morning, then you're probably the kind of person who learns from their mistakes. You're always discovering new ways to improve yourself, to grow, to become more efficient, to practice new techniques, to become what we might call the best version of yourself. You excel at your studies or your art or your sport or your hobby or profession or whatever. You know that your mindset and your actions are the keys to your future, and you work hard to perfect them. Although you're too smart to believe that you can be whatever you want to be or achieve anything, you do see the world as split between two groups: those who hustle and go after their dreams and are mostly successful, and those who are self-defeated, who fail and then make up excuses. Which means that your challenge in life is to belong to the first group. Now, a subset of this group, the high achievers, walk around with low-grade anxiety all the time. It gnaws at you. Every successful or beautiful person you meet reminds you of your inadequacy. Every time you try to rest or take a break or take a nap, you feel guilty. You only feel a kind of peace when you exhaust yourself from working and you can no longer go on. You complain about how little sleep you get, but you wear that suffering as a sign of your seriousness. I said low-grade anxiety, but that's not quite accurate. You might walk around with low-grade anxiety sometimes, but there are seasons or episodes when it's more than low-grade. It's a panic attack. It's the inability to get out of bed. It's depression, shame, dread, and ennui. Only a few people know how bad you can get, and almost no one outside of that small circle knows that anything is wrong. Your colleagues, your friends think you are highly successful and that you, unlike them, have your life together. But not everyone is a high achiever. Some of you are done. You're done with the whole game of adulthood or life or whatever this mess is. You know that the world is a highly competitive place and, frankly, you can't compete. The game is rigged and you know it. You've been told your whole life that your future is wide open to you, but you know that's a lie. Your teachers told you this lie because telling little kids that they can achieve their dreams improves their scores on state-mandated tests. That's it. It's a convenient, effective, profitable lie. Your managers told you you have a high ceiling because optimistic workers are more productive workers, even though they tend to burn themselves out. And since you cannot seriously compete, you may as well take your ball and go home, which is actually a more efficient, speaking of technique, it's a more efficient use of your time to cut your losses. The alternative is what's called the sunk cost fallacy, continuing to invest time and resources into a hopeless cause, which in this case is your life. Yes, the system works for some people, but what really separates the winners from the losers is how wealthy your family is or whether your parents stay married. You look at the high achievers and you know that their real achievement was being born to a wealthy family or born a certain gender or race or with a natural beauty or athleticism or intelligence and so on. And since you don't have those advantages, all you have left is to distract yourself. And society offers you a million ways to distract yourself. Society encourages you to binge watch TV shows, to watch porn, to drink, to excess, to play games for hours on end, to endlessly scroll through social media, whatever it takes to not participate in the rigged competition of life. The point is, you know that you'll never be successful and you're done caring. So you stop showing up to class or work. Every project is either turned in late or done with the absolute minimum of effort. I want to call this first group the affirming, because they look at the promise given by society and they basically affirm it. They say, I am my own. I belong to myself. If I take these responsibilities on my shoulders, I can live a full and satisfying life. The second group I call the resigned, because they have resigned themselves to the idea that the promise is a lie. it was never given for all people. It was always meant for the elite. So far, I've described these two groups as if people belong to one group or the other, but the reality is much messier. For example, someone can be affirming in one area of their life, their career, but utterly resigned when it comes to romance, or they may go through periods of affirmation and resignation. But of the two, I think resignation has the greater pull for us because the anthropology that shapes our society has no actual ends for human existence, no purpose, only an increasing number of means. Justifying your existence, what I mean is that justifying your existence is not a thing you do once. It's an ongoing process. You're always journeying and never arriving. If you're responsible for the meaning of your life, which is the promise that's given to us, you can never cease the labor of creating and sustaining moments of significance. If you're responsible for defining and expressing your identity, you can never stop expressing it. You always have to keep fine-tuning, discovering, projecting who you are out into the world, which is what we have with social media. Because your personhood is irreducibly complex, there is never an end to your searching. If you are your own, you can never stop evolving, progressing, and perfecting yourself through technique. The perfectibility of life through rational methods of efficiency is the bedrock of modern public values. If you are your own and belong to yourself, you belong nowhere and everywhere at once. You will perpetually struggle between your autonomy and the desire to surrender to a larger community of belonging. Resignation is the natural posture of people with no ultimate ends to pursue. This is precisely why one of the most common experiences of modern life is fatigue and burnout. And while Alan Ehrenberg, who's a historian of psychology, identifies inadequacy as the defining feature of modern depression, Ehrenberg is fascinating because he did a study on how people describe their depression, and it turns out that over the decades it's changed. He says, becoming ourselves made us nervous, being ourselves made us depressed. The anxiety of being oneself hides behind the weariness of the self. We experience life as weariness in part because we suffer from the anxiety of being our true self. It's not that work is a rat race. All of life in the modern world is a rat race. Often the only thing that separates those who affirm their self-belonging from those who resign themselves to it is the quality of the tools they use to cope, their self-medication. Now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at the alternative. Because as we're going to see, this anthropology is wrong. We are not our own. We do not belong to ourselves. And when we understand that, these burdens of self-belonging can be lifted off of our shoulders.